We are continuing our series today. We're going through the, which covenant? Which covenant are we going through? Davidic, that's right. And we have already spent, I think, two sessions on the Davidic covenant. We hope to finish it up today. What have we talked about the Davidic covenant so far? Anybody remember anything that's kind of stood out to you? Jeff?
Kingdom.
Okay, good.
And a king.
King and a kingdom. So we've been asking about the different promises that we find in the various covenants. And we said that the Davidic covenant promised a king and a kingdom. Absolutely good. Anything else that you guys remember of some of our study of the Davidic covenant? Things that stood out to you? I'm asking, Mark, are you questions a little bit more open-ended today, seeing how we do here. Julie, did I hear something there?
God said that he would be their God and they would be his people.
Okay, good.
And that he also promised them a promised land that would they wouldn't have, the buildings would be built, the crops would be up, and those were all things that he had provided for them.
Okay, now we especially saw those in what covenants? What covenants did we see those promises especially brought out? Abrahamic covenant was where we saw the promise of the land. And then to add to that, in the Mosaic covenant, we saw especially the development of the promises of blessings in the land. Like the notion, like you said, that their baskets would be fruitful and that kind of stuff. So I think this is helpful to see a sort of development along the way of how God is revealing his overall covenant of grace. That overall covenant of grace is not simply to have a land, but to have a good land, a blessed land, a full land. And that's what I think is so great about the Davidic covenant. Part of what makes that land and that people so great is there's a kingdom, a glorious kingdom, with an amazing king. And you remember in the Davidic covenant, we saw in one sense, well, let me say it. We saw ultimately it was unconditional in terms of a promise made. We did describe some aspect of conditionality in it, not in an ultimate sense. What was the notion of condition under the Davidic covenant? Tom?
Chastisement for wrongdoing.
That's right. So in David's line, if there was a king coming from that line that was needing chastening, God would chasten him. But what would he not do?
He would always have a line to David.
Yeah, the overall promise to David to establish this eternal kingdom with an eternal king, that promise would not be removed. That would ultimately come to pass, even in the midst of the chastening required to get us there. And so that's what we're continuing to work on today as we think of the overall covenant of grace being administered. And we've seen how it's been administered in the Abrahamic covenant and the Mosaic covenant and now the Davidic covenant. We've been thinking of this promise. And as we think of the Davidic covenant now, we've spent a good bit of time in like the book 2 Samuel. And remember, I said I want our study to be not just covenant theology, but kind of like a Bible survey as well, so that we understand where we are at in our Bibles. And so when we're studying the Bible, we know, okay, this covenant is operating here, and that needs to help me understand what's going on. And so what I want us to do now is move today beyond simply the historical books, beyond 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. We actually touched a little bit on beyond David in 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles. We talked about some of those kings that came in David's line, how some of them did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, some of them didn't. But I want to move beyond that and into the rest of the Old Testament. I want to look today at first at some Psalms. And I want us to help us recognize some of these psalms that are dealing with the Davidic covenant. And I want us to think then of how that helps us understand those psalms better. And I think it's important to note there that when you're studying a psalm, you have to understand the time frame. You know, if it's a psalm in the Psalter written by Moses, then you wouldn't have the Davidic covenant per se in your mind as you're reading a psalm written by Moses, right? Because that's prior to that time. But many of the psalms are either written by David or after David's time. And so the Davidic covenant and its promises are often in the backdrop of those psalms. Or in some of them, many of them, it's clearly at that time when the Davidic covenant is about to come or has come. Now they're beginning to wrestle with this idea. And then after that, I want us to look at a few of the prophets. And think about the prophets now. I mean, that's a big chunk of the Old Testament, right? You have major and minor prophets. And there are a lot of prophecies that deal with the Davidic covenant. Now, at the time of these prophecies, the Davidic covenant is enacted. But of course, the Mosaic covenant is still in the background too. And even the Abrahamic covenant. And so it's important when you're looking at these passages in the prophets that, again, you think in terms of covenant theology. Is this passage in some way dealing with the promises held out of the Davidic covenant? Even if it doesn't use the word David, if it uses the word kingdom and a promise about a kingdom, what should you be thinking? Davidic covenant, right? And if it talks about the law and the blessings or the curses in the prophets, what covenant should you be thinking about?
Abraham.
The law, I'm talking about the law. The Mosaic, that's right. If it talks about the forefathers and the promises made to them, who should you be thinking about?
Abraham,
that's right. And in some sense, sometimes you can see both of it, right? Because there's obviously a connection and some degree of overlap. The land promises made to Abraham get reiterated in a slightly different way, but similar way nonetheless under the Mosaic Covenant. So we can and should recognize both those things going on. So let's begin then going to Psalm 2. So we're doing the wisdom literature right now. We're in Psalm 2. I don't think we did Psalm 2 last time, did we? Okay, good. Suddenly, I know we've looked at Psalm 2 a few times. Suddenly, I'm having a memory issue here. Okay, Psalm 2, and I think Jeff volunteered to read the whole thing for us.
Why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision, then shall speak to them in his wrath and distress them in his deep displeasure. Yet I have set my king on my holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will give you the nations for your inheritance, and the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Now, therefore, be wise, O kings. Be instructed, you judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear, and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and you perish in the way. When his wrath is kindled but a little, blessed are all those who put their trust in him.
So my notes said we stopped before this, but I'm sure we talked about it last week. We're going to talk about it again, despite Neil saying we didn't hear. You're changing your answer. I'm going to ask the same questions I kind of deja vu remember asking you last time. How do we see Davidic covenant idea in here? Not in a grand explicit way, but I think we see a general idea here. Judy.
Verse 6, he sets his king.
That's right. So at the heart of the Davidic covenant is the need for this eternal king. And right here, God has set his king. And I think what I asked last week is we see a reference to a king earlier as well. Where do we see another reference to the king earlier in that? Sarah? Where is it in verse 2? You're right, but...
The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed.
So against his anointed, that's the key part. Because remember, what does the word Christ mean?
Anointed.
Anointed. What does the word Messiah mean?
Anointed.
Anointed. What language is the Messiah in? What language?
Hebrew.
What language is Christ in?
Greek.
Greek, that's right. So it's just all the same word. His Christ, his Messiah, his anointed one. They're taking their stand against the Lord God and against his Messiah, his King. And so this is very much a sort of enthronement song when it says in verse 6, I have set my King on my holy hill of Zion. Where's Zion?
Jerusalem.
Jerusalem, that's right. The city of David. And you have a similar sort of adoption type language. The Lord has said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. And there's an implication here for the nations. One of two responses that the nations, the Gentiles, can have. What are the two responses? Marlon?
Christ says you're either with me or against me.
That's right. That's right. The Gentiles will either kiss the Son, revere him, submit to him, or they will take their stand against him. And of course, what happens if they take their stand against him?
They're crushed.
It will not be good. And so remember, Davidic covenant, 2 Samuel 7. What did it say in terms of us, the people? What would God ultimately bring about? For the people. Okay. And most specifically about the people then and where they live. What will that situation be like when we have that king and that kingdom? It will be a place of what?
Rest.
A place of rest. That's right. Good. That's huge. So in that 2 Samuel 7, when that king and kingdom comes, God will have finally given us rest from all our enemies. And when you hear enemies, think Gentiles, think outsiders. But the cool thing is here it's kind of subtly described that the Gentiles actually have one of two options. Sometimes when you're reading the Old Testament, you think the Gentiles only have one option, be utterly wiped out and destroyed. But actually, there's this other option that you could kiss the Son, that you could join with in allegiance to the Messiah. And so that's right here, which we're thankful for, because I think all of us are Gentiles according to the flesh. Okay, let's flip over to Psalm 16. Mr. Marino, why don't you read Psalm 16 for us, nice and loud.
Preserve me, O God. Their sorrows shall be multiplied, who has them after another God. Their drink offerings of God I will not offer, nor take up their names on my lips. You, O Lord, are the portion of my inheritance and my cup. You maintain my lot. The lines have fallen to me in pleasant places. Yes, I have a good inheritance. I will bless the Lord who has given me counsel. My heart also instructs me in the right seasons. I have set the Lord always before me. Because he is at my right hand, I shall not be moved. Therefore, my heart is glad, and my glory rejoices. My flesh also will rest in hope. For you will not leave my soul in Sheol, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. You will show me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. At your right hand are treasures for evermore.
Good. So who wrote this psalm?
David.
David did. Yeah, we see it a little at the prior to verse 1, a miktam of David. And it's referenced in the New Testament as being a psalm of David. Acts 2, for example, talks about verse 10. So draw your eyes particularly to verse 10. You will not leave my soul in Sheol, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. Does anybody remember from Acts what it has to say about that verse? Yeah, so good. So he's connecting history, and he says David wrote a psalm. The temptation would be to think that this psalm is simply about David himself. But he points to verse 10. And then Peter points to the tomb of David. And says, David's body has faced corruption, right? I don't think they dug it up to prove it, but I think there was a point granted that David died and did not, immediately at least, rise from the dead bodily. Peter instead says, there was one, though, whom David spoke of prophetically, who did die and rise again. And in other words, Sheol could not keep him. He did not see corruption in the grave, that he rose to newness of life. So the resurrection, of course, proves this point. And it begins to answer the question, how in the world can we have a king that is everlasting? Right? I mean, if the Davidic covenant includes an eternal kingdom with an eternal king, it's interesting when you read that, it kind of makes you think like, well, how could there be this everlasting king and kingdom? And I guess maybe the non-supernatural side of us wants to, if we were in David's shoes, think like, oh, maybe he just means that there will be one, you know, human king succeeding after another. And that since you always have a king. But as we find out that God actually meant something more grand, that the eternal kingdom would be led by an eternal king, one who would not die. Pretty awesome. So, Psalm 16, we certainly, according to the New Testament, ought to see it that way. Let's turn over to Psalm 110. Jillian, would you read Psalm 110 for us?
The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. The Lord shall send the rod of your strength out of Zion. Rule in the midst of your enemies. Your people shall be volunteers in the day of your power. In the beauties of holiness from the womb of the morning, you have the dew of your youth. The Lord has sworn and will not relent. You are a priest forever, according to
this is also heavily quoted in the New Testament, and guess who it says fulfills it? Jesus. And I love verse 1. So maybe you've noticed this before, maybe you haven't. Who wrote this?
David.
So the Lord, who's that referring to? Verse 1? The Lord? Jehovah. How do we know it's referring to Jehovah? All capitals. See, L-O-R-D is all capitals. The Lord, Jehovah, or Yahweh, said to my Lord, that's referring to Jesus now, that's right, the Christ. And we notice it's not all capitals, you see that? So in Hebrew, if you're doing a little Hebrew, it says, Yahweh said to my Adonai. Adonai, you've maybe heard that Hebrew word. Adonai is like the more simpler word for Lord. You could refer to lots of people being Adonai, including kings. And so Yahweh, so this is David talking. Yahweh says to my Adonai, this is kind of like, you know, David being a prophet here. Thus saith the Lord, but not to me or to you. Thus saith the Lord to the Christ, or maybe to the Christ, to my Lord. And this is the passage, that verse Jesus brought up in his earthly ministry, combating with the Pharisees a little bit. Like, you say that the Christ is going to be the son of David, but then how come he would call his son my Lord? And he was kind of being a little edgy there, pushing him to think about that the scriptures say that the Messiah is going to be greater, actually, than just a physical descendant. And this begins to get at some of that mystery of the incarnation, that Christ is both Son of God and Son of Man, or Son of David. And so here we have this great message from Yahweh to the Messiah. And look at that first verse. What's he tell him to do? Sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. And of course, what did Jesus say he was going to do when he goes up? When he ascended? That's right. And so we often refer to right now what Jesus is doing as his kingly session. We have a session here, right? And that's like a session is an old term of authority. Ours isn't a kingly session because we have, you know, elders. It's a body that has authority. But Jesus as the monarch of the church sits in his kingly session, and not only is he doing his kingly work here, but there's another role that Jesus is doing according to this passage. What's the other role besides being a king? He's being a priest. That's right. Verse 4. You are a priest forever. Not only is he a forever king, he's also a forever priest. And so that's pretty exciting. And then, of course, verses 5 and 6 talks about how Christ is subduing the nations and will come in wrath and come in judgment. You know, often people think like, oh, the Old Testament, that's where God's so full of wrath. But in the New Testament, with Jesus, he's so full of grace and forgiveness, as if somehow there's some contradiction there. But we see it in the New Testament as well. But in this prophecy about Jesus, it says one of the things of Jesus, one of his qualities or characteristics, is he is going to come and bring judgment. And it's important to realize that his first coming was largely not for that, but his second coming, that will largely be what it's about. So this helps us to see these Psalms as they look forward to the work of Jesus Christ. And again, we should be thinking Davidic covenant here. The promise of a king that will bring a kingdom where God's people will be at rest from all their enemies, that's in Jesus. Any questions so far? So again, as we're looking at the Psalms, some of the Psalms, many of the Psalms, will be dealing with this kind of theme in one way or another. And so the Davidic covenant can help us to understand many of the Psalms better. Now, before we dig on to a couple of prophets to give us some example of dealing with the prophets, I might just mention, as we flip forward in our Bible, you've got, what's the next book? Proverbs. And who wrote Proverbs according to Proverbs 1, verse 1? Solomon, or at least for the most part. There are some other proverbs in there, but Solomon is recorded as this one giving wisdom, and he uses the language, my son, and so you can particularly think of how this would be him directing his own line, right, of how they can live in wisdom. And if we then take Proverbs and Ecclesiastes together, anybody remember what the book of Ecclesiastes is all about? Okay, interesting, yeah. Tong's quoting one of the references there about vanity, vanity, all is vanity. If Proverbs could be described in the height of Solomon's wisdom as the exaltation of wisdom, and look how great our wisdom does for us. Ecclesiastes is like now the opposite in some sense, where we see earthly wisdom has its limits, particularly when it's not in a context of following the Lord. And if you make earthly wisdom just about success in this life, then you're going to find everything is vanity. And at the end, there's a call to fear God and keep His commandments in light of the eternal judgment of God, and to realize that wisdom in general says, if you do good, good happens. If you do bad, bad happens. But Ecclesiastes realizes, though that's true in general, in everyday circumstances in life, it doesn't always work out like that. Sometimes the wicked do seem to prosper. Sometimes the righteous and the wise do fall under hard times. And so Ecclesiastes points us to a greater perspective, what happens beyond this life and age. And so it's a wonderful complement between the two books. And a reminder, I would say, that Solomon and his own descendants have only begun to grasp the wisdom that God would have for us. And I think we can then begin to see those books in light of the Davidic covenant. We need yet a wiser one. And Jesus picks that up, doesn't he? You want to remember how Jesus deals with that idea? He mentions that Queen of Sheba? That came from so far to hear the wisdom of Solomon, but yet one greater than Solomon's here. Jesus' wisdom, that wisdom from above, he possesses that in a way that the other sons of David did not. We know from reading about Solomon's own history, his own struggles, having all that wisdom, and yet still struggling to follow the Lord. And so that's just a little bit of background how you can begin to approach some of those books too. Let's look now at Isaiah 11. So, the prophets, most of them were preaching either just before exile or just as the people end up in exile. The last three, particularly in the line of, as we have in our Bible, deal with after they return back from exile. But the vast majority of them are dealing with this notion, you haven't kept the covenant, therefore discipline and judgment from the Lord is coming. You are going to end up in exile. But after that, God will bring about a restoration. God will bring about a regathering of the scattered. And so Isaiah 11 is very much about that regathering of the scattered, the restoration. I'm going to read it for us. There shall come forth a rod from the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. His delight is in the fear of the Lord, and he shall not judge by the sight of his eyes, nor decide by the hearing of his ears, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor, and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. He shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall slay the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt of his loins, and faithfulness the belt of his waist. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb. The leopard shall lie down with the young goat, the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole, and the weaned child shall put his hand in the viper's den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, who shall stand as a banner to the people. For the Gentiles shall seek him, and his resting place shall be glorious. It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people who are left from Assyria and Egypt, from Pathros and Cush, from Elam and Shinar, from Hamath and the islands of the sea. He will set up a banner for the nations and will assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. Also the envy of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, and Judah shall not harass Ephraim, but they shall fly down upon the shoulder of the Philistines toward the west. Together they shall plunder the people of the east. They shall lay their hand on Edom and Moab, and the people of Ammon shall obey them. The Lord will utterly destroy the tongue of the sea of Egypt. With his mighty wind he will shake his fist over the river and strike it in the seven streams and make men cross over dry shod. There will be a highway for the remnant of his people who will be left from Assyria as it was for Israel in the day that he came up from the land of Egypt. That's long. How do we see the Davidic covenant being worked out here? Tong?
Root of Jesse.
Okay, we see a reference to the root of Jesse. Remember, Jesse is David's father, verse 10. So there shall be a root coming forth from that line of Jesse. And Julie, you also had a comment there, verse 1, I think you said. See, verse 1, it talks about, again, the stem of Jesse, a branch growing up out of his roots. You know, I just cut down some trees. When I say I caused to be cut down through my money, some trees in our house, in our yard, and there's some little shoots coming out. Of course, for me, I'm frustrated by that, right? You know, I want this thing gone. But like when you see like a tree chopped off, right? You think that's it, it's gone. But here, you're thinking after the exile, it looks like the line of David has just been demolished. But now there's these little shoots coming up. And there will yet be one from the line of David who will come and bring about those Davidic promises. And you have to love the remnant language here. What's it describing? What's going to happen?
Julie. The Israelites were scattered and now they're going to be from Jerusalem and now they're going to be brought back.
That's right. And I love the various aspects of this. So why the reference in verse 13 between Ephraim and Judah? How the envy will be gone. What's going to be different now? What's that referencing, that envy between Ephraim and Judah? Marlon.
The two kingdoms, the north and south.
That's right. Ephraim really is representing there that northern kingdom. And remember Joseph, his son Ephraim, and so that's really representative of the northern kingdom. And so there was that separation before between north and south. Eventually, there's going to come a day where they're going to be united in the Messiah. The Christ is going to come and bring them back together. And of course, I love also in verses 6 and 7 and 8, this reference of the creation of the lion and the lamb being together. Now, here's where we have to use some good understanding about the prophets. And we'll touch base with one more of these next week because we're going to run out of time and then we really will move on to the new covenant. But has this passage come to pass? Yes or no?
No?
You're wrong. Has this passage come to pass?
No.
You're wrong. Has this passage come to pass? You're wrong. I know, I'm being facetious a little bit here. It has already but not yet come to pass. Already but not yet. And this is the trouble when you look at a lot of these Old Testament prophets. Because there's a way in which it has come to pass, but there's a way in which it hasn't come to pass. Do not put your baby next to a viper hole. Okay? Please, do not do that. No matter what they tell you on TV, as some TV evangelist, don't do it. But has the root of Jesse come forth? Absolutely. Has the root of Jesse begun to gather his lost sheep together? He has, hasn't he? Has he completed it? He hasn't. And so we see our reference there in verse 10. Hey, that's us. The Gentile shall seek him. So he's begun this. That little shoot coming out of the stump has come so gloriously with Jesus having come. And he has begun to gather. He has begun to repair. He has begun to restore. Already, he's inaugurated the coming kingdom of the Lord, but it's not yet come in its glory. In the glory times, then you can lay your baby down next to the little viper hole. Till then, don't do it. Does that make sense? And we'll look at another one next week, and maybe if I get excited, I'll bring a couple more in just to show you. This is very true, really, all the prophets that we see, that there's this already and not yet. If I had my whiteboard today, I'd write semi-realized eschatology. Eschatology is the end. It's been semi-realized. The end has already come somewhat. And this is really important. It makes sense of all these prophecies. We'll see when we get at the New Covenant, it says in Jeremiah 31 that God's going to make a new covenant. Not like the old covenant that your fathers broke, but a new covenant. Has that already happened? It sure has. That's what Jesus said. This is the blood of the new covenant. But when you read that Jeremiah prophecy, it then goes on to say how everybody from the least to the greatest then will know the Lord. And again, there's a sense in which that's happened in God's people that we now have a knowledge of the Lord. But when you read the Jeremiah, there's a certain sense of which it's going to be such a knowledge that we're going to know his law and keep it and never break it. And we know that's not fully here yet because we still struggle with sin. And so, semi-realized, the end, that's why it says in the New Testament, we're in the last days. There's a way in which the end has come, but not in its fullness. And this is that mystery of the two comings of Christ. He inaugurated the end, but he will bring it to glory shortly. We're out of time. We'll have to come back and keep dealing with this next week. Let's pray.